Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 337 for Friday, January 16th, 2015. Greetings from New York City, where I am preparing this week's show on Wednesday night after a very full day of speakers, panels, and interviews at Digital Book World here at the New York Hilton Midtown. That's located at 54th Street and the Avenue of the Americas, which is known locally as 6th Avenue. The highlight of today's program was an appearance by Russ Grandinetti, Amazon's Senior Vice President for Kindle. Grandinetti took the stage in the Grand Ballroom at 11:25 a.m. and for 30 minutes answered questions posed by veteran publishing consultant Mike Schatzkin and Michael Cater, another publishing insider who is the founder of an influential publication named Publisher's Lunch. I called this Grandinetti's visit to the Lion's Den in my live blog of the session because the mood of this audience is decidedly anti-Amazon, as indicated by how easily speakers can provoke appreciative laughter and applause by taking shots at the company. It's mainly people work for publishers and associated, I think, mainly with the New York publishing scene, although people come from all over as well. During the Grandinetti session, the ballroom was very quiet, no rustling chairs or sounds of coughing. It was the sound of 500 to 1,000 people listening intently, and at the end there was just a ripple of polite applause lasting 8 seconds. I give credit to Schatzkin and the organizers of this conference, now in its sixth year, for making the effort to get Amazon's top Kindle executive on the program. Earlier in the morning, I chatted with Mike Schatzkin and asked him if the apparent stabilizing of share between print and digital books means people in the industry are tempted to put less effort into learning about the digital side of the business.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that a part of the business, the straight text part of the business, the novels and biographies part of the business, is no longer undergoing the roiling change that it has been for the last 4 or 5 years. And people for several years would sign up a book in September and say, oh my God, what am I going to do with it in June? The world would have changed. And that's not so much the case in those areas anymore. It's much more about things that they know that they have to learn about metadata and tagging and communities and so forth. I think there's a little of consolidation of knowledge taking place now.
Amazon has a very intriguing and exciting role in this conference. You've got Grandinetti coming,
yes,
and then there's a panel that Ken Oletto is going to moderate.
Yes.
I get the feeling the room is maybe tends toward those opposing Amazon, afraid of Amazon. What's your personal sense of how to present Amazon to this crowd in a way that's helpful to them?
Amazon and Barnes & Noble now occupy serious monopoly positions. Right? If you want to sell a book online, you're going to have to do it through Amazon. If you want to sell a book in stores, you're going to have to do it through Barnes & Noble. They have the lion's share of the market in those two areas. And that makes life very difficult for publishers because their negotiating position is stronger than the individual publishers would like it to be. So I think that there's an inevitable tension as a result. And I think that the other thing, which is a part of this, although I think Amazon coming here and Russ coming here today undercuts this a little bit, Amazon's not really a full-fledged member of the book community, right? Amazon doesn't need ISBN numbers. They have their own numbers, right? Amazon can run a used book business, and nobody else in the world knows exactly what's going on with that business, right? So Amazon really created the ebook. Amazon really created the self-published author. And those are things which the industry, for better or for worse, would have had to happen a little more slowly. So there's a sort of an inevitable tension there, and I don't think that's anybody's fault. I think it's the nature of the beast. But everybody, if you're in the book business, you got to understand Amazon, you got to live with Amazon, you got to work with Amazon. So we're doing the best we can to make people understand what those realities are.
I recorded Russ Grandinetti's talk from fairly close to the front of the room, but there is still a bit of an echo in the room, and you may also hear someone typing nearby, and that's my contemporaneous live blogging of the session. I will have a link to that in the show notes, and it may help you follow along. I had asked for a chance to interview Russ Grandinetti after the session, but was told by Amazon that it wouldn't be possible this time. As he made a beeline to the side door afterward, I was able to say hello, and he apologized for not being able to do an interview today, but promised to catch up with me at another time. That will be good, but for now, he did offer plenty of intriguing insights into how the publishing world looks to Amazon these days, especially on the topics of Kindle Unlimited and subscription book services, as well as ebook pricing, Amazon publishing, and the pace of change. Here is what he had to say to a ballroom of publishers and related service providers, all of whom pretty much end up sneezing when Amazon catches a cold.
This week, actually, I've celebrated my 17th year at the company. I can remember when Amazon only sold books and only did it in the U.S. You know, from the very beginning, you know, helping authors reach the widest possible audience and earn a living for their craft is part of our mission. We do this in a lot of different ways that I think are sort of indirect. Perhaps the most important ways are indirect. When we do business with a publisher, we sell everything they have. So if you're a mid-list author that has trouble getting circulation in the channel, in many different channels, Amazon is a way to reach an audience that was not previously possible. That's geographic, that's format, that's category, that's channel, it's a lot of things. There's also more direct ways. You know, that we, over time, I think have really supported the author community. For years now, we've built a service called Author Central. It's got a lot of different services in it. But, like, just to point out some really specific things we've done, you know, we made it possible a couple of years ago for any author, no matter how they're published, to get access to book scan data instantaneously with geographic breakdown for free. We help them figure out how their audience is working, you know, again, no matter with whom they work. Today we have a variety of services, I think most prominently Goodreads, that authors at all levels of the chain actually use to connect with audience in a way that was not previously possible. And just based on the number of authors, the quality of them, the frequency with which they engage in services like that, I feel like in many respects that's very robust and very strong. So, and then of course, you know, in a more direct way, we happen to have businesses where we work directly with authors such as KDP and APUB, and they increase the number of choices in the marketplace for authors. I hope that they do things like help the authors a choice, not just about how they publish, but what they earn when they publish. And I think that's had a positive impact on the author community overall. So, you know, disagreements between retailers and suppliers in the book business, booksellers and publishers is not new. Certainly rarely does it become so public. I think our goal is to try and keep it rare. And particularly now that we've reached agreement with a number of our major publishers recently, you know, to spend the next several years focused on growing the business with them and to the mutual benefit of the authors they publish as best we can.
And you mentioned that significant independent author population, which Amazon has significantly empowered. And in fact, last year, when you were in the news, we heard from so many authors who created a livelihood through the tools and marketplace opportunities that you presented with them. Then later in the year, we saw that shift in some segments with Kindle Unlimited, where again, some people found it yet another innovative driver for their businesses, and other people came back and said, holy smokes, the landscape just changed.
Yeah.
Are there answers yet for authors who have reservations or questions about whether Kindle Unlimited is good for their business, whether they're participating in it or not?
Yeah. Well, just thinking about Kindle Unlimited and the indie community for a moment on the kind of author side. I should just sit back and just make a comment about the independent author community overall, which is, you know, they're awesome. It's an incredibly vocal community, very vibrant. You know, they like caps lock sometimes when they tell us what's going on. And, you know, that's, I mean, you know, we view that as a feature, not a bug. You know, the fact that they're so vocal about this is working well, this is not working well, we'd love it if you guys did this, we wish you wouldn't do this, is among the biggest sources of input that we use in choosing how we change, how we evolve, and what we build, and I think that's been reflected in how the services change over time. When you introduce something sort of big and new, like Kindle Unlimited, a new model, you plan well for it, you launch it, and then you kind of watch what happens.
Yeah.
We saw on your paper. And just stepping back, it's only 6 months, so I think answers would be a strong word for what we have. I'll offer a few observations of what we can see about how the whole system is working, and then some thoughts on where we go. You may know KDP Select is a program that authors enroll their titles in for 3 months. It's very short-term, relatively speaking. We look at, every month, the titles that come up for renewal, and every month in 2014, authors have renewed titles in KDP Select every month, but before and after KDP launch, in excess of 95%. So just in the aggregate, authors continue to choose to participate in the system. And actually, the total selection growth over that time, the total number of titles provided by KDP Select offers in KU has grown by 35% over the six-month window. Another way that we judge success is we look at the total earnings of offers as they participate in the service. Over that six-month window, if we just for a moment focus on the a la carte sales, so even setting aside what they earn from the subscription service, the lending lines, or anything else, a la carte sales of authors in KDP Select are growing faster than KDP at large and Kindle at large. And then finally, when you add in the money that authors earn from the subscription service, or have earned from the subscription service, as well as the Kindle Owners Lending Library, along with what they've earned from a la carte sales, you know, earnings over the full, by looking at the full 5 months, August to December, that we've traversed, and the earnings over that period in 2014 are double, more than double, what they were in the same period in 2013. So that's kind of some of the ways to think about the health of the whole system. There are thousands of authors and thousands of titles, and what drives their business includes what we do, but also there's a lot of other factors. When we hear authors tell us this is working for us, and especially when they tell us this is not working for us, we just look really closely at it to try to understand it. And I think the way our system is working today is good, but can be improved. There are ways we're looking at, in part inspired by the ideas we get from the community, where we think it's possible to tweak, improve, and better align what readers want, why readers subscribe to the service, and even better author outcomes. So we're looking at that now. I do think there'll be ways that we tweak it over the course of time. It's not surprising given that it's new. So the system overall is pretty healthy. I could just also add one more thing about it, which is, you know, we're incredibly motivated to make this work for that community. They only have to participate for 3 months. I mean, just imagine for a moment if authors could change publishers every 3 months. But I think it's instructive when you think about what our incentives are and how that community will hold our feet to the fire in delivering a service that works for them. So our motivations are, I think, are highly aligned with that community, and I'm cautiously optimistic it'll be something that's incremental.
I'm going to add on another front a point that you might have made that didn't, which is that the most successful independent authors are often so successful because they speak out, because they push their views out. So it's not sort of not surprising that they become a noisy community at any point in time.
Certainly there are prominent authors in the community that speak out a bunch. I don't know if I completely agree in the sense that, you know, we can see who the top authors are, obviously, and some confirmation bias around looking at who speaks out and are they top and why they get attention. There are many very successful authors who just choose to focus on writing and not engage in the discussion in the business, and, you know, obviously that's a very personal choice.
I'm going to shift the topic a little bit. Amazon's been on the record for a long time for wanting to deliver good value to customers and book prices, both print and digital. And Kindle Unlimited certainly feels like a downward push on e-book prices. On the other hand, your KDP royalty structure also suggests you don't want e-book prices to go to the floor, because you offer lower royalties if the price is too low, just as you do lower royalties if the price is too high. So, or above a band or below a band. How do you feel about how your trading partners are pricing print and digital today? It certainly seems like prices have gone down. Do you think they need to go down further?
Yeah. Well, there's always a difference between the price that people set and where demand goes. But pricing is is obviously an important topic. It's also extremely complex. I'll just briefly touch on, we have a little more time than you normally get in the space of newsprint to talk about structure, so I'll try to summarize. We think about it and analyze it at several different levels. I mean, there's the obvious level of just what price do I set for this particular title? And we, over the course of years, for both print and digital, have extremely robust models. We run highly controlled experiments at volume to understand for different categories and different titles and different stages of the life cycle what the elasticity curve for a title is. And so there's the individual, but there are several other levels to consider. The second one is probably just there are natural clusters of titles. All titles for a particular author, all the books in a series, all the books in a promotion. If an author has a four-title series, you think about pricing book one differently than the other three books. You know, so you have to expand the lens a little bit. There's a third level, which is just the system itself. So when we introduced Kindle with $9.99 pricing for new books, that was a system-level pricing decision. It wasn't a comment on the value of every single book in the chain in the same way that Barnes & Noble advertising 40% off the New York Times bestseller list wasn't a comment on every book in the chain. But it's a way to have customers think very simply about the value they're getting and come into the store and participate. I think the same is true with subscription pricing, which is a system-level pricing decision that you have to figure out how it affects the whole system. Being simple doesn't mean being simplistic. And then finally, and we said this a lot, and I've repeated, I'm sorry to repeat here, but it doesn't make any less true, which is, you know, particularly in a digital connected world, the degree to which books compete with other media is not going away. And customers evaluate what I'm going to do Tuesday night at 8 o'clock about, you know, it is Candy Crush, and it is Twitter, and it is books. And so, I mean, it's very complicated, but you must weigh all of those things in thinking about pricing. So it's no secret that in many cases, when we look across the catalog, we think there's opportunities, even on the individual title level, for lower prices to yield more revenue. And then there's these larger tensions with a larger system where I understand why reasonable adults can take an approach and think differently about them, different publishers do, but this is in our minds when we talk about pricing.
I'm just curious, you must have found cases where a higher price would yield more revenue.
Yeah, in fact, I would just say that, you know, for example, in KDP today, earlier this year, we released a set of tools where an author can put in what's my title, what's my past sales history, what category am I in? We showed them the actual elasticity curve for titles that have a number of characteristics similar to theirs. Now, you can pick what appears on an elasticity curve to be revenue optimal. In some cases, for some authors, that may be raising a price. And then, you know, what your mission is and how you go to market, how I think about pricing can not just be revenue yield in a particular case. And many authors report this isn't strictly how they think about a short-term pricing decision. So, and we do this with our larger publishers too. We share the data, and if we happen to be working in a model where we're not setting price, we want them to make the best possible decision. Sometimes they'll take our advice, sometimes they'll take it under advisement and make the decision they need to be best for their business, and that's cool.
In KDP though, you're directing those authors towards a certain price band by the way your pricing structure is put forth. Has that outlived its need?
I don't believe so. At least right now, I'm going to answer the question specifically within the context of called the trade business, meaning the trade fiction business. I think there's a good argument to be made about whether or not we should look at different models for other categories. When you start thinking of education or post-stem or other things, I think KDP can be a service in those areas. And, you know, we're thinking about how to evolve the system in the right places. But that system-level decision to think about when and how we pay to try and drive a great customer experience, I think serves the community well, at least based on the data we use.
So most of this conversation about Amazon and most of the way people think about Amazon is Amazon equals retail. But particularly over the last few years in our business, Amazon also equals publisher. Some of your own statistics that Jeff Bell shared early last year, he said that Amazon Publishing, and this is just Amazon Publishing imprints,
right,
was the third largest publisher of paid ebooks in the Kindle store by September, I think it was. It was up to the second biggest publisher. You announced international expansions as well. This is all up within 3 or 4 years of scaling. So how big is the ambition there?
And how
much of your own store do you want to see Amazon Publishing take up? And how do you expect people who compete with you as publishers, but also rely on you as a major retailer, to integrate that into their thinking?
Well, first of all, even step back to the company for a moment. You know, I think I agree that more publishers is good news, but not even more publishers necessarily. You know, more approaches to publishing, I think, is pretty healthy. You know, the more competition there is, the more choices there are for authors, the more we figure out what succeeds. And, you know, you guys know the business, you've been in it longer than I have, you know it really well. You know, historically speaking, the idea of a company that both publishes books and sells books is not new. from, you know, Doubleday and Scribner to B&M and Sterling. So we have business in Italy today, the largest three booksellers and the largest three publishers. The largest bookseller in Brazil is one of the major publishers in Brazil. So this idea is not terribly unusual. When we do things like Amazon Publishing, I mean, maybe there are publishers who say, wow, I wish those guys wouldn't do that. But it's not terribly useful conversation.
Think so.
It's not terribly useful conversation in the same sense that, like, years ago, you know, publishers were not happy that we sold used books. But obviously, that's great for our audience and great for our readers. I think ultimately it's really great for the business. And what happens in those conversations is, even if people wouldn't necessarily choose you to do it, they accept that you're doing the right thing for your business, and most of your conversations just focus on what you guys can do together. And that's my sense about how Amazon Publishing fits into things. I'd also just turn it around and say, you know, even outside of the fact that Amazon Publishing is super focused on happy authors, I mean, it's the number one way that they judge their success. We treat authors in that business the same way we treat buying customers. In fact, that team is doing a great job, and they don't just talk about this, like literally, rigorously, regularly survey all of our authors and ask how we're doing. They ask, how's the contract process, and how's marketing, and how's publishing quality, and how's the overall communication you hear from us. And in the same way we get feedback from buying customers and build it back into business, we're doing that with Amazon Publishing. I'm proud of the fact that we pay authors monthly. I'm proud of the fact that we have really good reporting and tools for the authors that we serve. And I'm proud of the many innovations that they've come up with, including things like works in translation. I think Amazon Publishing today is among the leading, if not the leading publisher of works in translation in this country. Because we, you know, digital has so changed the landscape for what publishing affords. And the cost of translation now have come down so much, you have to invest in the translation. You can try digital only, the book can be in POV. And you can see whether or not you can bring stories that are originally written in another language into English and vice versa. So, you know, I hope one of the ways that we measure the success of Amazon Publishing over time is the ideas we introduce, the practices we pursue, and, you know, I think it'd be cool if in the same way we look at other publishers and are inspired by what they do, you know, some of the things that we're innovating in, some of the things that turn out to be useful, make their way into the larger business. Frankly, even selfishly, that'd be great for us as a bookseller.
So as you evolve useful levers like Kindle First, I mean, that initiative didn't get a lot of attention, but your customers noticed. And those books go to the top of your list as soon as they're introduced. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing that you develop in Amazon Publishing but might open up to other publishers if they're willing to participate on the basis where you think it works? Or does it get reserved?
Full stop. It's actually a super good point. I mean, you know, it's been extremely healthy for us to be challenged by our publishing team, us as a bookseller. You know, in many ways, as a business, what we did for years was just try to optimize the store for the total aggregate sales that we generate. It's very natural for a retailer to think about doing that. And there are a lot of specific things that are different about not just saying, I want to try to sell as much as I can of all these books, but I want to try to sell as much as I can of this book. And so, you know, by having the publishing pushing us to try and invent ways to be better at that, I'm hopeful those tools, I think some of them already have made their way into how we work with publishers, other publishers on a regular basis, and I'm hopeful that continues. It's super helpful for us.
It looks to many people, including me, like things are calming down in the book marketplace. Mm-hmm. Both of the big shifts, that is from print to digital books and from store buying to online buying, seem to have slowed to a crawl. And that has been confirmed by data from the big publishers.
Yeah.
Do you see it that way? And if it's true that that's the case, will things be different in a more stable marketplace than they've been during the past several years while things have been changing at warp speed?
Yeah. I don't know what it is that when I hear questions like that, it makes me nervous. And the reason is because, you know, I hear it and I think, like, was there a panel at EEA in 2007, 6 months before we launched Kindle, that talked about how stable the business was? You know, was there a panel about the stability of the business in the mid-90s before Amazon was launched at all? And that's just focusing on some of the ways that we may have changed the business. So it's really hard to predict when things emerge that cause you to have to change the business in some respect. I mean, we only just recently introduced the subscription model. I have no idea what level that will end up playing out in the business. Could be small, could be bigger.
Well, it's certainly true that subscription over the past 6 months or a year,
yeah,
subscription is the one disruptive new element in the game.
But I hear your question. I also come at it at a slightly different angle, which is, I think, talking about the book business monolithically, sometimes we do a disservice to ourselves because it's many, many, many different businesses that function very differently. So just looking at the digital business today as it exists, as we can see it, you know, it's fiction dominant. I don't think that's really news to anyone. We sell many times more Kindle books fiction than we do in print. And I believe, based on the data we can see, certainly most fiction in the U.S. today is sold online, and I think it's possible most fiction in the U.S. today is sold digitally. And then when you look at other big segments of the business, trade nonfiction, children's, pro-STEM, education, they're much, much earlier in their development. Some of the technical challenges to help customers find as much utility in a digital book are much greater. And, you know, our mindset is not, you know, what's the predetermined percentage of the business that would be digital, but what is it we can invent that would cause customers to choose a digital format? And I think we're still very early in some of the things we can make, even in trade nonfiction. Even when it comes to business books and, you know, improving the interaction people have in that category, and then extending children's is even harder behavioral change. I'm a parent of a six-year-old. I was reading a Russell Hogan book to my son this week that I read when I was a kid. And even that connection over print is very emotional for people. And that's beautiful. And we want to support that. We have a great print business. I hope parents keep wanting to read their kids as best we can. But we also then turn around and say, what is it we can invent in the children's business that might make that be something that a parent finds fulfilling that comes from a different place? So how that plays out in the course of years in those other big segments, all those segments are bigger than the fiction business, actually. And they're still much, much earlier in their development. So we'll see.
We've mentioned subscription a few times, and I just want to dwell on it a little longer.
Okay, sure.
Because so many people are trying to figure out right now what that's about. You guys have obviously had a sort of experience with an experiment with subscription, not just Kindle Unlimited, but preceded by Kindle and their lending library, but you also have Prime, you know, Free Time Unlimited, and yet you sell millions and millions of individual items, so presumably you don't want to see your whole business go subscription either. I'm wondering if you can just help us understand what you think you've learned so far, where you might be experimenting next. It's also, it occurred to me until now, so if you don't have an answer, it's fine, but your statistics about the effect on the KDP Select authors is interesting. I wonder if you've also analyzed the trade publisher books that are not in Kindle Unlimited, but are in subscription plans elsewhere, to discern whether that exposure is, again, reducing the paid audience or increasing the paid audience.
Yeah. I don't have a good quick answer to your last one, but I'll
just encourage
you. Yeah, I'll do that.
Please look into it.
Again, just stepping back and looking at the whole system for a second, you know, we can all observe the fact that in every single digital media category, subscriptions is playing an important role. In music, in movies, in newspapers, you cannot find a digital medium where subscription isn't a model that succeeds at some level, and I don't think books will be immune to this. Immune is even the wrong word, because it makes it sound like it's necessarily a bad thing. I actually don't think it's true. And so what we need to do is think about how subscription can be a great value for the people, for the customers who participate, but grow the business and be incremental to it. In some respects, we have a harder challenge, and that's a great thing. That's a huge high-class problem, because the a la carte sales of books is so healthy in digital when compared with some of the other media. In music, people are just happy that there's anybody to pay anything for music, because many of those services compete with YouTube or piracy. So, you know, books doesn't suffer from that to the same degree. A la carte is healthy, so how can we structure it in a way where for the right customer at the right time and for the right publisher or author at the right time, it helps grow the business? Again, it's early. It's only 6 months. One of the ways that we gauge what's happening is, can we get people to read more? And we measure this in a few different ways. In that window of time, looking at several different ways of reading. So how many books do people read that we can see? How often do they read? How many times a week do they read? And then the total amount of time that they spend reading. All three of those, when people join KU, again, we're talking about, we have a robust sample for like 60 days before and 60 days after, appear to be growing pretty substantially. All three of those metrics are up about 30 to 40% for customers in the 60 days after they join the service.
Is this U.S. only, or is
I'm just focused on the U.S. right now, because we're even only a couple months into
the process. Can I ask whether it's possible that some of the growth you've seen is that when somebody goes to KU, they stop reading notebooks? In other words, could it be they're reading the same amount, but they're buying more from it, they're getting more from Amazon?
Yes, although, I mean, of course that's possible. We've always said this about Kindle, too, when we talked about when people buy a Kindle device in the year before they buy it and the year after, because now we have much longer samples, the multiple of the number of books we see them buy from us versus what they did previously. It's possible, and certainly true in some cases, that some of that's share shift. But the amount of growth, and triangulated a few other ways, make us feel like there's a significant amount of primary demand generation. Even if we're looking at people who are clearly steady Kindle customers and more had a history with us over the course of time, and segmenting it by quintile or decile, you can see growth in reading that's reasonably healthy post-training. So that's encouraging for us. And then the total dollars spent by that population in the 60 days after they joined, the total dollars, obviously including their subscription, but also off our purchases, is up about 25%. Again, based on the small sample that we see. So who knows how the trends play out? Our subscription services, as the audience gets broader, behavior can change in ways that are both called good for the system or maybe are challenging for the system. So we'll have to see. But there are reasons to believe that as structured today, our service can be a net increment for the business. I also think about it, this analogy doesn't hold perfectly well, but you know, today it's totally uncontroversial that in the life of most books, there'll be a hardcover edition and there'll be a paperback edition. And it's totally uncontroversial that the royalty rates for paperbacks are different than hardcover, and what an author might make per unit is different for a paperback edition than a hardcover edition. And that I think most people have come to understand that having both formats in the life of a book can be a larger yield for the publisher and author if done well. And so publishers think carefully about, do I start in trade paperback? Or when does the paperback come out? Or is it trade paperback? When's mass market? How do I think about that choice and increasing the yield for my investment over its lifetime? And while not a perfect analogy, I do think subscription will be a choice that a publisher or author considers in the life of a book. It doesn't mean every book all the time for its full life. It may mean, you know, I start in the a la carte business, it ends up with subscription, maybe the first series ends up in subscription, the rest is for a la carte sale. So how do people, you know, you see this in the movie business, does it go to theater, does it go to direct to video, does it go to the theater, when does it go to the pay channels? Which pay channel does it go to? How does it move into syndication? So it's not surprising that the flexibility of digital increases the number of possible choices you make for the model for a book over its life, and we're super early in understanding, you know, how that may play out, and it's obviously going to be very particular what choice a publisher makes or an author makes for her title at this time.
Does Amazon view what constitutes fair trading terms, that is, a fair division of the consumer revenues, differently in the print market, where the retailer is tying up capital and inventory, than in the ebook market, where there is no inventory investment? Now, we've read and heard Amazon say, maybe it was you, maybe it was somebody else, that a retailer margin of 30% of the customer spend is, quote, fair. Is that for both print and digital? I mean, how do you do that?
Well, just looking at the way print has worked for a long time, even before Amazon was a little thing, you know, booksellers keep in excess of 30% of the money a customer gives them for a book. You know, and for books that are sold at or near list price, it's more than that, more than 40%. And then thinking about the investments that a retailer makes in the digital world, although extremely different, are also pretty substantial and as substantial as what we might do in print.
Just not attributable to individual inventory items. It's more like technology.
When we sell a customer a book, the retailer now has the responsibility to support the customer's library over their life of ownership of the book or the app on that particular platform. I could go on. You mentioned inventory for retailers. The obvious, you know, response would be returns is one of the biggest problems. Doesn't exist. We could just recapitulate that. There's a million blog posts on this topic, but you know what? I just add in that 30% of sales was what publishers came to us and told us they wanted to give us in the agency model. So
when I wait.
All those factors, and look at it together, you're asking if I think it's fair. I think, you know, a retailer keeping, you know, on the order of 30% of what a customer gives them for an ebook is absolutely appropriate.
One more terms question, and then we're going to kind of be out of time. One of the positive outcomes of some of what's happened recently is that it does look like, for the first time since like 2010, we're going to have some terms stability in trading relationships between you and major publishers, and that's going to hold for several years now, which is good for you, it's good for the publishers, it's also good for the consumers. It strikes us that that also probably presents some opportunities for other things that could be happening in the marketplace, both on your side, but also things that you think publishers should be thinking about while we have this period of stability. So what does that call to mind? And it also makes me think that people don't take advantage of that period. We're going to find ourselves a few years from now thinking, boy, we missed the opportunity there to make some progress while there was a stable landscape.
Contracts don't necessarily equal opportunity. I think we'd be focusing on our interests, and I think the interests of publishers are so highly aligned in so many ways that to the extent you can actually work your way through any disagreements you have, you can turn around and then absolutely focus on some of the big opportunities, geographic expansion. I talk about focusing on some of the categories because I think publishers can play a role in making children's nonfiction, education, or any of the things that we talked about, you know, a really attractive growth opportunity for them and their authors in digital. And so I am hopeful. It feels really good to, like, be able to spend as much time as possible focused on how to grow the business together. And so I'm encouraged.
Russ, this was great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I want to add comments from Michael Cater and Nate Hoffelder, author of the authoritative Digital Reader blog, who was with me in the press room. These are comments that I recorded after Grandinetti's talk.
I'm Michael Cater. I run Publishers Lunch, PublishersMarketplace.com, Publishers Lunch Conferences, Publishers Lunch Buzz Books, Brand Extension.
How difficult was it to arrange this pretty intriguing conversation that just took place at Digital Book World?
You know, I think no more or less difficult than any of the other executives that we put on stage here. Mike Shaskin, my partner, and I have had a productive relationship with Russ Grandinetti and David Ngar and others at team members at Amazon for years. I think they understand that we're putting in the room the people they're doing business with all the time and decision makers, and we try to create a context in which we can learn and speak productively with each other, and we appreciate that Russ appreciates that, and he'll come if he thinks he has something to say or thinks that the audience wants to hear from him, and if he doesn't think he has anything interesting to offer, he'll take a pass or wait for the next opportunity. So, you know, we were pleased that he was here. It's a year in which this community wants to hear more from Amazon and get a better understanding of their thinking and their planning and where they're heading and how book publishers fit into their landscape. So I think Russ fulfilled our hopes there.
If you were writing this story for the Wall Street Journal, what would your lead be? The news that he left on the stage.
I'm probably the wrong guy to ask, right? Because I'm in the moment conducting the interview. Unfortunately, I have two people from my staff listening to it and taking notes. I think, you know, in my journalist head, the things that stood out for me the most were the metrics that Russ shared, I believe for the first time, about some of the effects of Kindle Unlimited on KDP Select authors, which I thought was interesting to hear. And I was interested in his broader thoughts about where subscription models fit as a piece, albeit a growing, encouraging piece of their larger business. Because I think everyone here, again, is wondering, as Russ started to explain, is will subscription eat the business? Will it grow the business? Is it a part of the business that everyone needs to think about where it fits? So, you know, given that he's a retailer, I thought he gave some very helpful context there.
He seemed to push back on Mike's idea that we're in a period of stability. Did that make you wonder if there's something brand new that's right around the corner that he couldn't talk about?
You know, what I heard was Russ saying this business has been fluid since they started it, so they're loath to place any long-term trend adjectives on what's given, what's happening at any given time. Look, there's no denying the broader statistical measures we can all access, right? Which is the book business itself is fundamentally healthy and seems to be growing, and yet market share among major retailers, at least in the U.S., seems to have been relatively stable, and percentage of business going to digital versus print, at least in the U.S., seems to have been relatively stable. Again, macro, because publishing is 100 markets, right? And as Russ said, you know, fiction is one market, nonfiction is a different market, children's is yet another market. So when we talk about stability, you know, we're looking at those macros. And I think he's running a business where he's looking at 100 micros stacked up. So I don't think that's covering for some secret plan, although he can go prove me wrong shortly. You know, I think, look, everybody's looking for growth, right? And Amazon, in some respects, needs more growth than everyone else because that's what's fueled the company. So, and at the same token, they never want to tell people it's not growing anymore because that's not their mandate. Just like no other executive in this room can go back and tell their board, we're done, no more growth.
My name is Nate Hoffelder. I edit a blog called The Digital Reader.
What did you think of Russ Grandinetti's comments here today?
He was pretty good at tap dancing around a number of key issues. He's aside from the few statements about the earnings, I'm not sure that he said much of substance. Or there's a few hints of Amazon's intentions that was interesting, like maybe changing the KDP pricing model to reflect different markets, like textbooks or nonfiction would have a higher price. But that's really just speculation on his part, so let's not read too much into it.
The Kindle Unlimited data seemed to indicate that they had measured the effect on a la carte sales plus the subscription sales. Was that newsworthy?
Yes, that's what I'm working on right now. Yeah, it's something of a surprise given how many authors have been complaining over the past month and a half about Kindle Unlimited harming their sales. And apparently Amazon's saying that's not the case.
Have you gotten indications of that from authors independently?
Well, I only have the same data that everyone else has, but I did note that last year a number of authors complained of a similar drop in sales, which we thought was because the Big Five books were going on sale at lower prices. But now I guess it looks like the drop in sales last year and the drop in sales this year might be related. It might be a cyclical change.
If you'd been able to catch him on the way out, what have you asked him?
I just wanted to fact check a few details, that's all.
Yeah. Any sense of the reaction in the room?
I was paying too close attention to my nose, I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
No, there were no fruits or vegetables thrown on the stage, so. Oh, that's why it was before lunch and not after. Okay.
That's it for this week's episode from New York City. In coming weeks, I'm going to bring you more highlights, including what happens here tomorrow, Thursday, when there will be a lively debate about whether Amazon should or can be constrained. And then also I'm going to have a chance to attend a separate debate, which is the IQ2 series, and that's going to be tomorrow evening after Digital Book World shuts down. The resolution before that group is going to be Amazon is the reader's friend. I plan to bring an open mind to that session and to tell you what I learned. So it's going to be lots of talk about Amazon here in New York City before I head back to Boston on the train on Friday afternoon, I think it is, and then back to Denver on Sunday. Also, on Friday, I'm going to have a chance to visit the Open Road Media offices in Soho. Really looking forward to meeting Jane Friedman, who's been on the show, and some of the other people that I've worked on various projects with Open Road, including the interview with John Ashbery, which was was that last week? I'm losing track of the episodes here, but Open Road is a great organization, and I'm going to look forward to seeing their offices here in New York before I head back to Boston. Music for my podcast is from an original Thelonious Monk composition named Well You Needn't. This version is Ramonk by Yval Monagat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording. This is Len Edgerly on the island of Manhattan for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.